call the Resource Committee meeting to order, March 28th, about 3:05. First thing that we're going to do, go over the confirmation of Phil Smith to the Commercial Fisheries Interest Commission. Is Phil here? Phil, would you like to come on up at this point in time and a little background of yourself? We'll open it up to questions from the committee after you've had a chance to give your name we represent for the record.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Phil Smith. That's Philip J. officially. I'm currently a member of the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, a position I've held for the last 6 months. I was appointed by the governor last, I believe it was in mid-August, and I went to work in the commission on the 3rd of October, so I'm just right now wrapping up my sixth full month with the commission. I can't claim to know everything about the commission, its history, and all of the technicalities, but I do have I believe at this point, a fairly good experience base under me for the position. With respect to my own background, it may be helpful for the committee to know that I've been an Alaskan since I was about 10 months old. My father and mother came to Alaska in 1943, and we traveled with the FAA, lived in a variety of places. We lived in Northway for a while, we lived in Summit, King Salmon Naknek area, Annette Island, and Cordova. And it was in Cordova where I was graduated from high school and where I got most of my hands-on background, I guess, with the commercial fishing industry. I worked on a seine boat, drift fishing, and also had done some set netting out in the Quijack in Bristol Bay in the 1950s. Have also been involved with cannery work and things like that. After serving in the Army for a little bit over 3 years in the late 60s, I returned, finished up a degree program at Golden Gate College in San Francisco, returned to Alaska, and I've been a resident of Anchorage since 69, participating professionally there primarily as director of the Rural Community Action Program for about 7 years. I was also deputy director of that program for 2 years. In 81, I went to work for the Alaska Native Foundation, where I directed the research effort for the better part of a year. I resigned and made a run for the state senate in District D. I've also, during the year or so prior to my appointment to this position, I was a private consultant. I worked with a construction company and a couple of other organizations in primarily management consulting and things of that nature. I believe I have a fairly broad background in resources, resource economics, rural economies, and the status of the folks in rural areas and so forth. And that being said, be happy to answer any questions.
Sure. Thank you, Phil. Representative Gowdy, you had a question.
Yes. You indicated that you have been a commercial fisherman.
Yes, sir.
Do you have or do you have any permits now, or limited entry permits, or any of your relatives have permits?
No, sir. I have had no formal contact or involvement with any aspect of the industry since the last time I went out on a boat, which was out of Cordova in 68.
What's the difference between a set net, drift net, and a first net permit? Or do you have any knowledge of?
Well, yes, under limited entry, there are approximately 31 separate fisheries that have been limited by the legislature and the commission over the years. Fishery is defined by type of gear, species, and area. So it's possible, for instance, to hold a Bristol Bay set gill net entry permit for salmon and a Prince William Sound drift gill net entry permit for salmon, and any number of mutations there. seining is an entirely different type of gear from set nets and drift nets.
How many fathoms of net is the Cook Inlet set net are allowed compared, say, to a Bristol Bay set net?
I believe they're the same.
They're the same?
I believe so. I can check on it and get back to you. I didn't.
I think the limited entry is currently under challenge in the federal Supreme Court, if I'm correct. Do you know anything about the status of that now, and what would happen if the state loses the case?
Well, there are different theories on that, sir. The number one, I'm not an attorney, and the state is a party to that suit, and so I'd frankly not like to discuss too extensively whether the status of the case, but my understanding is that the basic legal challenge is to the transferability clauses in the current Alaskan program. And it is entirely arguable that if the state of Alaska were to lose that, and the net effect being that all transfers of permits would have to be effected through the commission, that the free transferability that currently exists would no longer be permitted, and the commission would have to establish some type of lottery system or something like that to determine who could be eligible to obtain a permit once its holder desired to leave the fishery. As you might just see a massive bureaucracy down here called the Limited Entry Commission, which sat there and did all kinds of adjudications and tried to figure out who might be eligible. There are some arguments, I suppose, that could be made that might be a good idea. On the other hand, I'm not convinced at this point that free transferability doesn't work more effectively and with less governmental interference than any other system.
Yeah. But before that, just for the record, I forgot the people were in attendance. So Representative Larson, Representative Bussell, Representative Gall, Representative Liskin, Representative Cowdery, myself, Dick Schultz are in attendance today.
If I could follow up, just being a commissioner.
And Representative Ewing.
Is being a commissioner on the entry commission a full-time 9-to-5 job? I was wondering if all the other members are full-time, or what kind of a workload and the number of staff and things like that.
First off, yes, it is a full-time position in state government. There are three commissioners on the commission. The staff of the commission, I think currently we have authorized 37 positions, which includes, in addition to the internal administration of the organization, a research staff, which is required to meet the mandate of economic profiling of the various fisheries, data processing staff, adjudications and application, and licensing. The commission, in addition to deciding on the administration of the act and the actual implementation of the entry system itself, also has a mandate created by the legislature in 77, I believe, to license all the vessels in the state. So we have a rather extensive data processing capability to try to keep up with that as well.
What's the pay scale for your appointed position?
It is set in the statute at 26C. I believe that's $63,636 a year.
What's the overall budget for the commission?
63,636, sir.
You have an idea on what the overall budget for the commission is?
It's something in excess of $2 million, slightly in excess of that. It's currently under discussion by the House Finance Committee.
Do you have other sources of personal income besides what you'll have on the commission?
Not of any significance. My wife works.
But there's no conflict of income?
No, sir.
I'll probably.
Any other questions? Representative Lister.
Hey, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Smith, you state in your itinerary here that you're a Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
Yes, sir.
What did you do there? What basically what did you do?
I was executive director and chief executive officer of the organization for 7 years, and deputy director for the 2 years prior to that, from 73 to 75. Would you like tasks?
Yeah, what was your function? Now, you could have been a president of it, but what did you do, though? What the act and program stand for? I'm not familiar that much with the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
Well, it was a program designed under the Federal Economic Opportunity Act, which passed the U.S. Congress in 1964 as part of the Johnson War on Poverty effort. And it was a program which existed as a private, not-for-profit corporation chartered under state law, but with the federal authority of the, as I say, of the Economic Opportunity Act. It had a board of directors of 27 individuals, a representative of the various regions throughout the state, as well as all levels of government. The governor had a position on the board, and Representative Larson at one time, when he was chairman of the Mat-Su Borough, was on the board representing that area of the state, and involved itself in a variety of programs and activities identified by the board as being a benefit to low-income persons who lived outside the municipality of Anchorage. These included such things as the operation of Head Start in about 37 villages from southeast to Barrow and back again. Also, weatherization programs, home weatherization, energy programs. We had a fuel loan program to help villages when they ran out of fuel. They could come to us and get a loan instead of going someplace else to get a grant. Variety of different types of service delivery. And as chief executive officer, it was my job to maintain the wishes of the board and implement those as a chief administrator, keep us out of trouble with our auditors and various funding sources, to represent the board at for the legislature and the Congress and various other places where there was a concern.
I have one more question here, Mr. Chairman. Under your military experience here, it says in here you're qualified for special forces. Were you jump qualified?
No, sir. I qualified.
How could you be?
Pardon me?
How could you be qualified for special forces if you weren't jump qualified?
I'm sorry if that's misleading. I was accepted into the special forces training when I was at boot camp at Fort Ord in 64. And following that, I opted not to go into special forces and served as a medic instead. But I was accepted into the program. I was not a qualified special forces Green Beret.
That's very misleading. I agree with you.
Oh, I apologize.
Representative Cowder, you got a follow-up question? Any other? Go ahead.
Yes, I have some other. I don't want to, but I have a couple more questions I'd like to. What type of decision do you feel that you're making now, or if you're confirmed? In other words, I was wondering if you have to make a decision between, say, user groups. Do you have any? Would you lean towards more towards commercial, subsistence, or sport users?
Representative Cowdery, that would be outside of the purview of the Limited Entry Commission. The major types of decisions that we make are quasi-judicial in nature, and they have to do with an individual's application for an entry permit. The question of allocation of a finite resource amongst different user groups is currently, constitutionally, and by statute, the responsibility of the Board of Fish. And although we work with the board and the Department of Fish and Game, in fact, we're appended to them for administrative purposes, we don't presume to tell them how they ought to slice up that resource.
There's some. Do you believe that there should be limited entry on the Kenai River for fishing guides?
There is currently no authority whatsoever for such a program.
I know. I've just asked your opinion, your belief.
I think it would I think my answer is, you know, quite bluntly, I'm not sure. I'd have to see a lot more information on the impact of guiding and so forth. I couldn't give you a yes or no answer at this point, sir.
In a questionnaire, you say that any development near a fisheries habitat would have an adverse impact on the resource. And I think you also state that you oppose the OCS leasing plan, the Knick Arm and Turning an Arm Crossing and the Susitna Electric Project because of their potential adverse impact to the fisheries. So I'd just like, can you tell me what adverse impact the oil development in Cook Inlet's proven to have on the fishery? And do you have any plan to use your position to oppose, you know, Bradley Lake or Susitna or anything like that?
Well, I think that the questionnaire to which you're referring is one that was distributed by United Fishermen of Alaska to candidates for office in 1982. I believe that my answer speaks to questions of a much larger policy nature than that addressed by the Limited Entry Commission. So I guess, simply stated, what I may or may not feel about oil development or Susitna is totally outside the purview of the Limited Entry Commission and would not be something over which I'd have any control or influence.
But I think that we're asked to confirm you based on of your views towards if you're qualified and it's going to best serve the state in this position. And I think that some of these questions should be answered so that we can make intelligent decisions on recommendations of the committee to your confirmation.
I understand
that. And that's why I don't know if you had stated in this questionnaire it's true, and I was just wondering if that's still your position, and if you believe that the development Cook Inlet had any adverse effect on the fisheries.
Okay. I don't think that the development of Cook Inlet, the oil platforms, has had any measurable adverse impact on fisheries. I think that other development projects need to be looked at pretty carefully to ascertain what impact they may have on fisheries prior to approving their construction or whatever. Certainly Bradley Lake does not fall into the category of a project which may have an adverse impact on fisheries. I think that's the verdict on that one's already in.
The Knick Arm Crossing and Turnigan Arm Crossing, Susitna, do you have an opinion that that would have an adverse effect on the fisheries?
Well, I'm not a biologist. I would hope that prior to those projects going forward that somebody would take a look at the question of whether or not they'd have an adverse impact. Is certainly conceivable insofar as they would, depending upon how they were designed and engineers, could conceivably block returning spawners from river systems that are required for the production of those salmon.
So you don't think that the Bradley Lake or Susitna, either one, or just the Bradley Lake has no problem and the Susitna may have problems?
I believe the Susitna may, yes. In fact, the study that was put out by Acres American, which I haven't read for 2 years now, and so I'm not going to quote it exactly, but it stated in there that there would be an adverse impact, but they felt that mitigation measures could be taken, and certainly that study is ongoing. Fish and Game has a whole staff looking at that very issue.
Do you believe, what type of political activity do you think a member of the Fisheries Entry Commission should be involved with, or do you think they should be involved in any?
Well, I am, as you're undoubtedly aware, a Democrat.
Sure.
And have been relatively active in the party at the time that I was appointed. I resigned my position as chairman of the, or president of the Bartlett Democratic Club in Anchorage, and still remain a member of my local precinct, but other than that, I hold no political titles, party titles, and frankly think that it, anything much above a precinct level is probably inappropriate.
Thank you.
Representative Lister.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple more questions here, since you, we're to confirm you or recommend you for confirmation to the Limited Entry Commission, Phil. You familiar with the halibut moratorium we run last year, problem we had?
Yes, in general terms, yes, sir.
What's your feelings about it? Do you think it has merit? Should it be looked into? Protect our fishermen up here, or have the Washington State people come up and clean us out? What's your feelings on it? You're going to be in a position where, if you're on this board, where you'll be able to do the Alaska fishermen some good up here.
I'd like to preface my comments, sir, by stating that the Alaska Limited Entry Commission would not be in a position to implement a halibut moratorium or a limitation. That program was proposed by the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council and the International Pacific Halibut Commission. It's really outside of the purview of the Alaska Commercial Entry Program. As a general rule, however, answering your question, I believe that the proposal for a limitation on the halibut fishery was frankly poorly timed, although some form of limitation may be indicated. The facts available and so forth and the process that was proposed may well have worked against the interests of Alaskan shore-based fishermen. I'm also like to say I'm not an expert on what was proposed, and so I prefer not to get into much more detail than that.
Well, I realize that too, but we're either for or we're against something, and if we have the occasion to be, we go on the side of our people instead of somebody else. I want to know where you're coming from.
Right. Well, my hesitation on thinking that was a great idea, sir, was that it was a share quota system whereby a certain allocation percentage of harvest would have been allocated, and there are a lot of people in Alaska who are latecomers to the fishery whose percentage of harvest historically is fairly small, and they would have been unlimited of that. And so I had some hesitations. There are other Alaskan fishermen, primarily in Southeast, who felt it was a great idea because they had historically harvested a large amount of halibut. So I guess from the fisherman's standpoint on that, where you stand depends upon where you sit.
Well, I've got another question here. I don't know whether it is pertinent to actually your position or not, but I'd like to see how you, what's your feelings are, I know you're not a biologist, and I'm not a biologist, but we're coming up with a lot of controversy here between aquaculture associations and the state hatcheries themselves. Do you have any comment on that? What's going to happen here? And we have so many aquaculture associations raising their own fish, and they come into a certain area, and they say, well, these are our fish now. And you've got limited entry people out there wanting to get them, you know, by your permit system. You see what I'm trying to say?
I really don't understand the dimensions of that issue well enough to comment on it. I understand conceptually the potential conflict between state hatcheries and private nonprofit hatcheries, and that there have been some efforts to transfer PNPs to, you know, to state control. I have not followed the debate, sir. I haven't read the documents, other than the general statement that I think fisheries enhancement programs are, in most cases, a good idea. I have a difficult time giving you a good answer to that.
You think the Limited Entry Commission is working right now? You think it's working good?
I believe it is, yes, sir. Okay. We do have a rather large backlog of cases which require our adjudication, and being fair takes time. we do need to, you know, speed up that process and give people answers who have applied for permits, but other than that, I've been frankly very pleased with the quality of the staff at the commission. You know, I entered government last October after having been outside of government for the better part of my adult life, and you know, at Rural Cap and every place else, we stand around and take shots at government. That's a fun thing to do, and I was quite frankly quite impressed with the quality and the quantity of work that is produced from the commission. I'm proud to be a part of it.
Well, my big concern is right now is so many of these permits are being held by people in Seattle and all the way down the West Coast, and they've gotten out of state. I don't know if you being on a commission, you could do anything about that. Could you sure recommend type of legislation we here could do to try to resolve this problem?
It's one of the concerns.
I don't know what percentage is outside the state now, but there's a whole bunch of them.
Commission just recently completed a rather detailed transfer study that analyzes the ownership permits and where people live, and I believe that just within a couple of weeks ago, that was distributed to the legislature. I think our current records show that of all the transferable held entry permits, 78% are owned by Alaskans. And that means 22% are owned by non-residents. At the time of initial issuance of permits in 1975, 79% were issued to Alaskans and 21% were non-resident. So the actual aggregate percentage of in-state versus non-resident holders of those permits has not shifted significantly. I believe that the legislature has already taken some steps through the loan program and other things to try to ensure that those permits remain in resident hands. And perhaps more steps could be taken to ensure that they remain local to the fishery as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Liske. Representative Gall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of brief brief questions. To clarify your last answer, if you had the opportunity to structure limited entry or other regulations such that the position of the Alaska fishermen would be enhanced at the expense of the out-of-state fishermen within the law, is that a policy that you would tend to support as a matter of course?
Yes.
There is data to justify the assertion that there is a trend out of state,
yes,
rather than in state, and rather than pursuing it at this point, you would be open to absorbing that information and trying to use it to increase protection for Alaska fishermen?
Oh, absolutely.
That's
yes.
Fine. On the halibut issue, one of the issues that was very basic to the concerns of Southeast were opposite to the impression which you had received, and that was that the small boat fishermen, especially the young, or including the young people in some of our smaller villages who depend upon the $2,000 or $3,000 worth of halibut income to make it possible for them to attend school and so forth, these are users who are terribly important to me politically, insofar as these are the citizens that we're speaking about. They may not dominate the commercial interests, but they certainly do dominate the population of halibut fishermen in many of the small communities. Do I understand that your reluctance to approve the share quota system, if that were part of your purview, would be in an effort to protect those small boat fishermen? In other words, would you be able to assert publicly that you feel protection of the small boat fishing interest is basic to the responsibilities of the commission? Shall I rephrase the question?
No, I'll try to answer it if you'll bear with me. The small boat fisherman, the coastal Alaskan fisherman, is, given my own background and interests and proclivities, I think, of incredible importance to protect those interests. Mm-hmm. Now, when I was commenting on what was speculated to be a share quota system in halibut, one of the concerns that I heard from fishermen who were small boat coastal Alaskan fishermen was that by locking them in, essentially, to a small quota, that they were the ones that were being harmed by that proposal, which is one of the reasons that I found it real difficult to say, hey, this is a great idea.
I agree. That's the reason why I found it intolerable, because it would create a situation that, I mean, all economic history will prove that it would create a situation where those people would eventually be bought out of the market in times of crisis, and we never have an opportunity to return. So certainly share my view. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Gohl. Representative Bossel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Smith, I've only got a couple of questions. Do you feel like a limited entry permit should be a piece of personal property that's willable at time of death?
I do.
Do you think it should be a piece of common property that's divisible in time of a divorce?
Well, as a permit, it authorizes the operation of a unit of gear, so I don't think it should be divisible, no. The legislature took great pains to ensure that the permit was an exempt piece of property, and I believe that is worth hanging on to.
Then you'd set a price on it and let the price be divisible in the divorce?
Perhaps, if that was the nature of the settlement, yes.
Mr. Smith, if you were on the commission and such a scenario took place where, let's take Bristol Bay or something, because that seems to be where it happens occasionally, and a strike took place and we followed the prescribed methods laid out in statute right now, and got down to we couldn't reach an agreement, and it got down to where a strike was going to take place, and the resource was going to waste, and clearly going to go to waste. There was no settlement possible in the strike, and the canneries are sitting empty. What do you think the commission ought to do, or should it do anything at that point?
Well, the strike
beyond
is
beyond what's allowed right now.
Yeah, it is clearly, you know, outside the purview of the commission to do anything about it. A strike is a result of free economic choices made by individual independent fishermen grouped together in a union and cannery interests. It shouldn't affect the permitting system at all.
Well, the purpose in finding a fact for the creation of the commission, though, you see, does require that the commission consider the resource first. Mm-hmm. So how would you say that you were holding yourself as a commission member, along with the purpose and facts and finding and ignoring a situation like that when the resource went to waste? Does the commission not have an obligation to do something to do something about the resource? Do you just ignore that?
I think that, along with most other Alaskans, commission members would feel that there is a great tragedy going on, and perhaps, you know, at the point, Representative Bossel, that a strike has reached an absolute breakdown point, it's too late for any government agency to come in and harvest that resource. One of the things that the commission has done, and I have encouraged it and would continue to encourage it, is under the authority of a legislative resolution last year, the number of which escapes me at the moment, the commission was involved in an effort to obtain wholesale prices of salmon and general overall economic profiling of a fishery in order to get adequate data to both sides in disputes of that nature in advance of impasse in order to help avert such strikes. I think that given the information available to the commission, as well as our mandate, that's the most effective thing that we can do.
You don't think the commission could go any further than that by inventing or having a backup system of fishermen to harvest those if they couldn't reach it to save the resource?
The commission doesn't have any legal authority to do that, sir.
Okay, you don't think they should look at that or anything?
No, it would be up to the legislature to create that capability.
I think the legislature listens to people like the commission and fashions legislation on it. It's really, it's a, the legislature can't reach to all those situations. First of all, they can't even know they exist, and they're not in session when that happens. They're certainly not close to the situation, and legislatures tend to listen to unions on one hand and processors on another hand, and spending half the session trying to get a clear picture of what goes on. People on the commission should have more liaison with the legislature to try to get their desires across, it would seem to me. Mr. Smith, I'm somewhat confused yet with your answers to both Representative Liska and Representative Gall over your position on limited entry and its constitutionality. Do you believe limited entry in its present form is constitutional, or don't you?
Yes, I do.
You do believe it's constitutional?
Yes, I do.
Okay. It seemed to me like you gave both answers today to two different people, and I'm somewhat confused by it. That's all the questions I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Bustle. Are there any further questions before the committee at this time? Representative Cowdery?
Yes. Then you've changed your position, I think, in your questionnaire, following up on Representative Bustle, to the Fish Pact. You said that you thought that it was a constitutionally questionable, the limited entry permit, I think, if I read this right. It says, I led the effort of rural cap to defeat the proposed repeal of limited entry. And it was my feeling, and it remains today, that providing a property right to individuals in a common property resource is constitutionally questionable. But you've changed your position on that now?
No, sir. I mean, it's still constitutionally questionable. It's before the U.S. Supreme Court at this point. My feeling is that it is constitutional. But it is questionable because people are questioning it. And there are various aspects of it. Having worked for the commission now for a half a year, I've become a lot more sophisticated about some of these legal questions and feel, answering the same question now, I'd say I'm more comfortable that it is totally constitutional. However, it is still being challenged on constitutional grounds. First and 14th Amendment, among others, or 5th and 14th.
Yep. Representative Cowder. I have just a brief question here to Mr. Smith. On your Fish Pact questionnaire, which I have in my packet here, you speak of user groups such as sports fishermen and commercial fishermen, even though I understand that's not necessarily under the purview of the Limited Entry Commission. Perhaps you could clarify your meaning there when you say you state here, additionally, in areas in which there is extreme competition between user groups such as sports fishermen and commercial fishermen, there is a clear need to set up a special systems of communication and conciliation. If the board were to fail to do that, I would seek the necessary legislation to accomplish that. That, I imagine, is if you were had been elected. Perhaps you could explain what your intent was behind that at the time.
Well, at the time, I was running in a district that included the Kenai Peninsula and the Kenai River, and it is clearly an area in which there's a lot of conflict. And I felt that it was, in fact, necessary to set up some type of administrative mechanism to try to address those conflicts external of the normal shouting matches that occur on a semi-annual basis. To a large extent, that's already happened. The Kenai River Commission was appointed. The governor has submitted legislation to address some of those problems. The board itself is, I think, incredibly responsibly been handling the issue over the last couple of days. They're setting up their own committees, and I think that that's what I mean. Sometimes it's necessary to go one step beyond what's already in place in order to solve a specific problem where there's intense conflict, and that's what I was proposing in that.
Okay, very good. What kind of goals do you have with the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission? Do you have any kind of goals where you'd like to see the commission go, and what would you like to see it be accomplished?
I'd like to see there's sort of the technical and bureaucratic goals. I'd like to help wade through the backlog of adjudications that are in front of us and try to give people some better answers. I think in a larger sense, or in a more philosophical sense, I would like to see the commission contribute to the effort to Alaskanize, if you will pardon the gerundive, to make the fisheries really Alaskan fisheries and to localize those fisheries so that the economic benefits of the harvest of our common property salmon is most beneficial to those who live near and those who depend upon those resources. It's not to say that I think that limited entry is a social program. It isn't. But it is a program that affects fisheries in 90% of the Alaskan coastline, which is the only real economic base. I'd like to ensure that that economic base remains healthy. Beyond that, I'd like to see the commission achieve a greater degree of sophistication in its economic profiling of the fisheries, and be able to provide better information to the legislature, the governor's office, and the other policymakers regarding various economic trade-offs and different choices and so forth. We have a rather impressive research team right now, and you know, I believe that that's important, that we continue that capability. I'd like to be part of the agency that, from my observation, has one of the better reputations of state agencies around, and I'd like to maintain that and, if possible, enhance it.
Yeah. Just one further question. You stated you wanted to Alaskanize the fishing industry. Maybe you could be a little bit more specific on what you see as the ends for that. How would you accomplish those things? You're talking about, I imagine, more local control on fisheries management. Is that correct?
Not necessarily that, at least those things within the purview of the commission. I think I'm share with most of the members of this committee and the legislature and Alaskans in general a desire to bring some permits home. You know, in an age of free transferability and in an age in which the aspirations of Alaskan policymakers are subject to zobelization, or the, you know, the inputs of the U.S. Supreme Court in equal protection, there's no simple answer to that. But I'd certainly dedicate myself to an effort to, you know, work to help make the loan programs perhaps more effective, and the other mechanisms that are legal and available to us to bring those permits home and make sure that it's Alaskans who benefit from harvesting those resources.
Representative Liska, then Representative Fossil.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I feel if you could answer me one thing. I don't know whether Representative Bussell was getting at it, but I don't think I heard the answer. You say limited entry actually protects the resource. I believe is that what you say?
It contributes to the protection of the resource, yes.
How?
Well, the alternative to limited entry is unlimited entry. And to the extent that one of the variables that a biologist must deal with in managing a resource is the amount of effort that's going to be put into harvesting it, by stabilizing that effort at a given level, then it will have contributed to sound biological management.
Well, let me ask you one more. Do you think that we're talking about the constitutionality or the what have you of the limited entry permit system? I talk to a lot of people all across the state, and I know one case of an individual leave out of Naknek where he dumped a whole load of fish down there because it wouldn't give him a, he said he wasn't qualified for a permit, entry permit. So the individual was denied the right to fish and sell. But there's literally thousands of people who would be out in Cook Inlet, I'm sure in Bristol Bay also, that can't qualify for these permits, or which are native people up here, our own people. So I'm just asking you this question. You say there is a question whether or not it's constitutional or not to have these limited entry permits. And you're also saying we need it to protect the resources.
Let me clarify that one once more, if I may. number one, you're quite right when some people are permitted to do something and there are a limited amount of permits available. Clearly, a whole bunch of people aren't going to be permitted to do that thing. The question that is in front of the U.S. Supreme Court now on the constitutionality of limited entry has to do with the question of free transferability of the permits. In other words, treating the permit as chattel property, something that can be bought and sold rather than something that is issued by the state and returns to the state when it is no longer used by the individual it was issued to. So that is the constitutional question. The Alaska Constitution was specifically amended in 1972 to provide the legal constitutional framework for entry limitation. And it was shortly thereafter, in I think about 3 months in 73, that the current limited entry law was passed by the legislature.
You're right, sir, but there's a whole bunch of people dissatisfied with the whole system the way the setup is right now, which the mechanics are in place. I just wanted your opinion. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lister. Representative Bussell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Smith, another thing come to my mind, I guess, when I was listening to you talk there. How do you divide in your mind the commercial interest in fishing when we talk about a reason? Let's talk about the Kenai River. Enjoy your answers. You talk a little bit about it. What's going to happen, or what's going to go through your mind when the set net permits on the east side of the inlet, the fishing pressure in the Kenai and the overwhelming pressure by the sports fishermen want to claim that resource from the commercial fishermen? How are you going to handle that? That we're at that point now. It's a point you're going to have to grapple with.
Well, fortunately, at least under the present structure, I'm not going to have to grapple with it. So that's really an allocation decision that has to be made by the Board of Fish. To the extent that there are set net permit holders on the east side of Cook Inlet who allegedly or arguably or even demonstrably intercept salmon bound for the Kenai, that's a question of really biology and allocation policy, which is far beyond the purview of the Commission. The Commission currently has no authority to engage in a buyback program for those permits or anything of that nature.
Well, but you agree that it certainly has something to do with the thinking of the board's members and the commission members. For instance, someone suggested that we go to the use of fish wheels there. Obviously, that's going to fall right directly into the commission's hands. That is a means of capturing salmon or a means of harvesting the resource.
Yeah, I think if the board established a fish wheel fishery, which on the east side of Cook Inlet, they would discover that it's a very inefficient way to harvest fish. Fish wheels operate in rivers. If they were to establish such a fishery or any other type of fishery that was commercial, then this commission, if it were asked to, would take a look at whether or not it needed to be limited and whether or not permits needed to be issued in it.
Yeah, forgive me, I should have said
right.
Trap. I think
traps.
You were talking about traps, not wheels.
Right.
I got carried away
right.
There.
Of course, you know, one of the reasons we're a state today is because of fish traps. And the enormous fight during the 50s, I can remember them vividly, the commercial fishermen versus the feds and the whole fish trap issue and so forth. So I think it'd take a rather giant leap of legislative faith before such a program could be implemented.
We got a kind of a giant problem out there right now. It's 250,000 sports fishermen that are different, that weren't here. Statement times, and we have a river there that they're claiming, and they're claiming the resource in it. And they obviously have a lot of legislative might. That huge step you're talking about may have already been taken just by counting them.
Could be.
And I guess, sir, it's a problem that you're going to have to face. Now, being flippant about it is not going to solve it. It is a big problem. Sports fishermen are claiming and offer some proof. We had them here cover that entire wall. And offer proof that you cannot turn your head away from, that they contribute more to the economic well-being of the people on the Kenai Peninsula 10 times over than commercial fishermen do. Not just a little bit, 10 times over. And it is a big problem. And And sir, it's not just a Board of Fishery problem. It is a problem that the commissioner's going to have to face, too. I don't know what we're going to do about the licensing. We're all going to have to go forward and try to solve it, or it's going to override us all. And while we're talking about the Board of Fishery, how do you feel as a commission member about the present makeup of the Board of Fishery? And I'm talking about sports fishermen versus commercial fishermen.
Mr. Smith, do you want to direct your, just through the chair, just recognize the chair when you answer questions.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I appreciate that.
All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, in response to that question, I believe that it is a good board.
As appointed,
yes, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Representative Bustle. Representative Cowdery?
Yes, we have Mr. Smith scheduled up for coming on another date for a future hearing. I know we have some other bills that we want to deal with today. We do have two other bills we're going to deal with. We're not going to make recommendations today. Let me find out here.
What was the word from the today would be fine?
Today?
Today, unless there are further questions.
I would hope that we would have, it's my understanding we were going to have another day to ask on this. It was scheduled up for 2 days, according to...
We have it on schedule for 2 days, Brad?
Yes.
It is scheduled for tomorrow, and then we will hold it over until tomorrow.
Thank you. I'd like to get to the other...
Okay,
other,
then let's hold those questions off until tomorrow. Representative Larson, unless you had an earth-shattering question, you certainly need... can have the floor.
No, I want to apologize for having to be absent, but the questions I have I can ask tomorrow, although I would have no objections to moving on today.
Okay, very good. Are there any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Smith. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You'll be here on hand tomorrow then.
3 o'clock tomorrow?
Right. And then we'll wrap this up.
Thank you.
Okay, at this time we'll now go forth and take House Bill 639, and we have Representative Harriman's here to testify on the bill. House Bill 639, an act making a special appropriation to the outdoor recreational open space and historic properties development fund and providing for an effective date. Representative Harriman, you do have the chair for.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members of the House Resource Committee, I'm Representative Adelaide Harriman and represent Bristol Bay, the Lucians, and Turtle Off Island. I'm the sponsor of the bill that you have before you, House Bill 639, concerning funds for the Outdoor Recreational Open Space and Historic Properties Development Fund. Actually, you have before you just a part of the package legislation that I introduced on historic properties development funds. The other bill, House Bill 640, has been favorably reported out by the Loans Committee and is currently pending in the House Finance Committee. That bill changes the eligibility requirements for the state grants to be the same requirements currently established under the federal program. The benefit of this change is to allow grantees to qualify for both programs, and funds could then be used as matching grants. The bill that you are considering is the appropriation to the development fund that has been defunct for several years as no money has been appropriated to the program. It would be great at this time to maximize efforts in the area of historic preservation by providing the state funds. We have not received any opposition to the bill. We have, however, received verbal support for both bills. Unfortunately, those comments were not provided in writing for formal presentation. The cities of Sandpoint and Unalaska, as well as the Division of Parks, have expressed their support for state funding. To bring you up to date on the federal funding question, I am pleased to report that the Division of Parks, Department of Natural Resources, estimates the federal portion for fiscal year 85 to be $414,500. It is expected that amount may be as high as $640,000 as referenced in the operating budget now being considered. When asked what spurred the introduction of these bills, I relay the following situation which is at hand. There are many residents in Sandpoint that are very concerned about renovating the Russian Orthodox Church, which has been admitted to the National Register of Historic Sites, which means it is open to the public, a requirement for placement on the register. admission to the register also gets us out of the problem of separation of church and state. They have organized, conducted bake sales and other revenue-producing activities in order to raise funds to save this historic and cultural structure. They are also willing to provide the labor and other services in kind. There is very little chance that they can actually make enough money to restore the structure, at least not fast enough to beat the rapid deterioration and rising cost of such a project. The dilemma presented itself. No funds are guaranteed from the federal government, and the state has not funded the program set up for the purpose of historic preservation. In addition, as a group, they would not qualify for state matching funds, as the eligibility requirements for the state limited recipients to municipalities. This bill would go a long way in providing some relief to municipalities, and if the other bill makes it through, to individuals and organized groups to proceed with restoration and conservation of historic structures. In my district, timing is very important, so funding this year is likewise important. The Department of Natural Resources also supports this legislation. The request that was channeled through my office is by no means the only request for assistance. They can provide you with names of other needy projects that we are faced with losing should no help be offered. Any assistance at this time would prove helpful. If the state deems areas and structures to be of historical significance or providing a valuable recreational environment, the state should be looking ahead to assure that it will be around for the enjoyment of future generations. The state needs to be involved in the effort of preserving our past. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Herman. Are there questions, Representative Larson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would this grant be in addition to or part of any grant that presently is within any of the capital improvement budgets?
You mean for individual people that put in historic preservation grants? Yes, it would be in addition.
It's in addition to.
I just wondered if you.
Does that conclude your question?
Yeah.
Okay, any further questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Liska.
Thank you. Representative Herman, last year I believe we approved something similar to this for the southeastern totem pole restoration. You remember that?
I think there was a request for restoration.
Shakes or something with it.
Chief Shakes.
Would this be something on about the same system here, trying to retain those historical totem poles down there compared to what you have down there on this Russian Orthodox Church?
Yeah,
would it be a similarity? I mean, for what purpose?
Could apply for it, and you know, things like the historic church and the totem pole restoration. I think if they have an organized group or through the municipality, they could.
Do you recall the amount we appropriated last year for those totem poles?
Yeah.
I don't remember either.
It was up there.
Pretty well up there, wasn't it?
Questions? Representative Larson?
Thank you. Who would this grant be made to? What, is the State Department?
It would be through the Department of Natural Resources, since they have the mechanism to work with this historic site.
Thank you, Representative Larson. Any further questions? Thank you, Representative Herman. Ned Farquhar, do you want to come forward? State your name for the record, because you are being electronically recorded.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ned Farquhar from the Commissioner's Office of the Department of Natural Resources. And I'm sorry that Commissioner Winnick is unable to be here today. She's out of state. The department supports the concept of the bill, but having taken part in the governor's budget process, we naturally support the governor's budget and don't support any authorizations outside that budget. That's up to the legislature to decide. Of course, we don't want to be seen as going around the governor's budget, obviously. However, I thought some background information on the grant fund might be useful. The Outdoor Recreational Open Space and Historic Properties Development Fund is administered by the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation in DNR. It was created in 1976 by an act of the legislature and appears under Title 41 in the current title. In 1976, the legislature authorized the issuance of a bond issue of about $6.6 million. About $2 million of that, as I understand it, went into the fund that we're discussing today. And that money had all been spent by the late 70s, so we've been without any funds in the Brat Fund since about probably 3 or 4 years ago. Any state agency or a municipality in the state may apply for outdoor recreation, open space, and historic properties development fund money by submitting to the Division of Parks a copy of their application to a federal grant program, or submitting evidence of authority to undertake a project for which funds are requested. The statute was designed to provide matching funds for grants under the Federal Land and Water Conservation Grant Fund and the National Historic Preservation Fund. At this point, we aren't sure what kind of funding will be available in those programs in coming years. I'd be happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Okay, are there questions? Representative Bussell has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How many applications do you have for funds now?
I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure how many applications are pending. From the money that we had, the $6.6 million bond issue in 1976, we funded about 54 projects. Since then, I'm not sure what applications have come in and how we've processed them. I believe it's been, we've probably rejected a number just saying we don't have any money in the grant fund.
So that's what happens, you get an application, and if you don't have any money, you reject it, or do you keep the application?
It probably varies year to year, Mr. Chairman, and I'm not sure what the Division of Parks is doing. I'd be glad to provide that information.
Well, I think it's important. We're talking about $500,000 going into a fund. If you have applications there for $9 million, it doesn't seem to me like we're not accomplishing what's going on here. The sponsor of this legislation just testified before you that she has some things down the chain that they'd like to aim these things at. And obviously, if we can't provide a mechanism to aim them at, it might change somebody's opinion as to what they ought to do with this. How do we make any kind of a guarantee or that any of this stuff is ever going to find their ways into the projects highlighted by the sponsor?
Mr. Chairman, we have a process in the Division of Parks for processing the loans under regulation, and I'm not sure whether I misunderstood your question about whether or not there were applications, formal applications for funds or requests for information about how to apply. We've had a lot of different expressions of interest, many of which have been probably denied by the fact that we just don't have any money in the fund. But let me find out what kind of applications we're kind of looking at information.
Seems important, Mr. Chairman, if we're trying to do something we don't know what we're doing.
Representative Larson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know whether this question would be best for Mr. Farquhar or for Representative Herman, but it seems to me that in House Bill 639, we're really asking for $500,000 from the general fund for outdoor recreation, so on and so forth. And then for a companion bill, 640, we're asking to change the rules. Might not we be taking these in the wrong order?
Mr. Chairman, I would defer to Representative Herman. I don't know if there have been hearings in HB 640.
I think
my concern there was
Representative Larson. Yeah.
It is a companion bill in that it attempts to change the rules by adding the words in person, I think, which means that an individual could also be eligible. And I guess where my concern is here, Mr. Chairman, is that before we play the ball game, we should know what the rules are. And maybe we should be taking up House Bill 640 And then after that, 6:39.
Is 6:40?
Well, it doesn't come here.
Committee, it didn't get this, didn't get the committee referral to resources in that, for whatever reasons.
Okay.
Are there any further questions? Thank you.
I'll provide that information, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We will hold this bill over one more day then. Okay, at this time, we'll now go to 4:58.
What is this?
I'll get a hold of it.
Do you want to take the chair?
Sure.
I understand.
Okay.
I understand.
Well, you take this.
It's matching funds, that's what it is.
Okay.
Resource Committee's kind of playing musical chairs today with their chairmanship. Is Representative Bettesworth here to testify on 4:58? He was just outside the hall there. This bill, before we do have someone to testify, this bill is a bill that has been getting quite a bit of notoriety, publicity, or whatever, primarily throughout the South Central and the interior of Alaska. And we've had various comments on this piece of legislation. A lot of people are having a hard time understanding just exactly what it's saying, even though we've attempted, and Representative Bettesworth and I attended meetings in Fairbanks, and we attempted to very explicitly inform the people as to what the intent of this legislation is, and there still seems to be some problems with the people being able to understand exactly what we're trying to do. The intent of the legislation is to provide fee simple title to the people. There's some problems in maybe in going back and affording fee simple title to the people in the have been awarded land through the through other sales where they had ag rights only. But the intent of this legislation is to make sure that we dispose of all land in the future, and we give fee simple title. If we have to attach a covenant of whatever type it may be to it, stipulating that it's for ag or whatever, that's the intent of the legislation. But at the same time, we'd like to retroactively go back and include the people that are found themselves in a dilemma, primarily because they cannot, the paper that they get after they paid the loan off isn't worth the paper it's written on. It's virtually worthless. Representative Bettesworth, have you come up and...
Mr. Chairman, if it suits the committee, there are other people here to testify, and I would like to hear their testimony before I testify, if it's okay. If there are other people, if there isn't, I certainly...
Okay, T. Whitehead, come up and testify, please. Give us your name, who you represent, for the record, please.
Okay, my name is Paul Whitehead. I go by Pete. I'm representing myself as an ag owner in the Gus Davis Agricultural. That was 1979 leases. And basically, what I would like to talk to you about is the bill. I'm in favor of Bill 4:58, and to talk a little bit about what you said when you started out. Analysis of the bill, the purpose, it's evident that the legislature enacted, and I'm reading from Bob Bettesworth's information that you have in your packet. It's an act relating to agricultural rights to land. It's become evident since the legislature enacted the legislation allowing conveyance of designated agricultural land with only an agricultural easement. Basically what it's saying is, I have the right to trespass on the land. The owner leases and the signs have very little in the way of concrete, definable legal ownership. What is actually conveyed by the state is in fact no more than an easement to utilize the land for agricultural purposes only, and the restrictions result in the owner or legal occupant leaving traditional fee simple ownership rights and benefits with the state. Speaking of which, if you were to lease a piece of land and build a business on that land, someone could come by. With the way this is set up now, somebody from the state could come by and say, we're sorry, but you parked your car wrong on this piece of property, so we're going to take it away from you. You lose your buildings and everything. Okay. On page 2, on that same report, we're going to talk about there's certain conditions that have to be met. And this is under major elements in the House bill. It's Department of Natural Resources shall convey remaining rights of to agricultural lands if requested by the owner, leasee, et cetera, and conditions are met. Now this is in the bill to be changed to that. Certain conditions that are on the land right now, basically for me to clear my 85 acres that I have to clear to qualify for this parcel that I've got, if I hire someone to come in and clear that land, I'm looking at approximately $1 million at the current rate for somebody to come in and clear that commercial. So this here figure is before I buy machinery, fertilizer, build housing, do any planting, harvesting, or shipping. So basically what I'm looking at is more than a lifetime investment just to clear this land. Okay, after we clear the land, we have to meet certain conditions on it. In other words, to plant the crop. And after we plant a crop, we find out that due to shipping costs, basically what we wind up with is 35 cents a pound to ship stuff, and you can figure anywhere from 18 to maybe 25 cents a pound for it to come back. That's what you'll get back out of your product and sell it. We're looking at continued outlay of money. And part of the problem I see is I think that the legislature, whether it was they were misrepresented or whether it was somebody else that had a wonderful idea that we should get all the lands out to the people, and we had a big push, the lands were set aside. I do not feel that the Gus Davis land area, which I'm basically talking about, had the proper consideration or whether that should be agricultural. I don't feel like whether it was Department of Natural Resources that should have made the studies on it or whatever, but I don't feel that it economically it can be utilized as agricultural land due to the location of it, transportation costs, everything involved. And I think the people who put in for it, and I'm talking about everybody who put in a bid on the land, not the ones only that drew out on it, that were lucky enough to get a lifetime investment there that we can get nothing out of, but everyone who put in for those lands were misrepresented. And I feel like at this point in time I would be unable to sell the land because I don't own it. I own an easement to it, and there's nobody going to buy it. Now we have in your packet here we have a letter, and this was from K.D. Strong. And it says, when I found out, basically the third paragraph, it says, when I found out that we couldn't get fee simple title after clearing, I've put the project on hold waiting further developments. And basically this is for this bill. Alaska has great potential and a bright future. We'll develop free enterprise. If Alaska will develop the free enterprise and let the people do it, it will benefit. And I think it's very appropriate. The same person also has a letter from a bank, a And if you'll read in that letter, basically it tells you that you'll probably find until you're able to obtain fee simple title, rights or ownership will be questionable. Basically, you won't get any money from any of that institution. There's also a letter from a lawyer here stating it would not be wise to make any improvements of a long-term nature, as any decision to terminate the forfeiture would be at the result of anybody basically in the state that wants to pull it away. I feel like if you pass the bill, 458, we're at least in the right step to taking care of some of the problems. Without ownership of the land is worthless. It's a liability right now instead of an asset. And I'll go ahead and conclude at that point.
Okay. I have a question. Representative Larson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I may take a minute just to tell you where I'm coming from, and then of course ask you some what I consider to be hard questions so that I can, but back when I was mayor of the Matanuska Susitna Borough, we established an ordinance at that time in which we hoped would preserve agricultural lands within the borough. Some of the things we did at that time, of course, was to sell these lands at competitive bid, and we started the bid price at 10% of the value. Once the lands were disposed of, we had a covenant on the title that it was agricultural rights only, except for 5 acres of the land in which you receive fee simple title and you put your home, your outbuildings, and so forth. That has seemed to work rather well. We also did insist upon a farm plan being implemented, because otherwise we'd have individuals that would file on agricultural land, simply come in and harvest the timber that was on it, sell that off, and then give up their rights. So we had to make them put some sweat equity in it. So that's where I'm coming from. Now, some of the questions I would have of you, do you feel, say at the time of the Gustavius disposal, that if the land that was put up for disposal was offered at a fee simple title instead of ag rights only, that there would have been more people interested in that disposal and therefore have taken part and brought a greater revenue to the state as a result?
Well, I'd have to say yes, because it doesn't have the agricultural implication on it.
Okay. Then if the state was to change the rules in the middle of the ball game now, should any of these people who before were excluded because it was ag rights only, should they be brought back into the picture, or should the person who obtained the land with the ag rights only in order to get fee simple title, should there be some additional compensation to the state?
No, I don't feel there should be, no. I feel a misrepresentation on the fact that it's not suitable for agricultural in the location it's at because of the market value.
What has changed between the time of the disposal and now that no longer makes it feasible for agriculture?
That's why I'm saying I think that the Department of Natural Resources misrepresented the people that put in for that. The time frame and all when you put in for the drawing didn't allow ample time to find markets and figure costs and I think it was a misrepresentation on that point.
If I may, then, you understood the rules. You just think the way in which the rules were being applied or put out to the public misled the applicants for the disposal at that time.
Yeah, I think it was misled, yes.
Is it the land that's not agricultural, or is it the economics and transportation that makes it not economical to be farmed?
Well, it's both. We're talking about an almost straight sand soil situation where everything that you do will be heavily fertilized in order to get a crop. And you're talking about freight costs both directions. In other words, bringing all of your fertilizers in, also moving your product out. There is no local market.
Okay, it has been suggested in several times that it was to be changed from ag rights only to a fee simple title, with a covenant in place that the land could only be used for agricultural purposes. Would that be satisfactory to you?
At this point, I could see no. I would not be opposed to that. No. And the reason being, at least I could go to the bank and borrow some money and try and build up something. I bought a Caterpillar because I had to have one in order to clear it. Talking to Natural Resources, they said that none of the state monies would allow me to buy a Caterpillar. I could not get a state loan to buy one because of that agriculture. And so I bought the thing through the local bank. And the only way that I can get money through the local bank in order to put it on that is, of course, collateral through the tractor, but also the fact that we had the savings account in the bank.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, if I may continue, and let me add just a little bit more. Since we had our last meeting on this bill, I have checked with a number of people who are much more knowledgeable than I am. And for that reason, the feedback that I get is, under the present law, we need some changes. However, we need to also kind of secure or to maintain the guarantee that that land will remain in agriculture. And if I may ask Representative Bettisworth a question, what guarantee could I tell my folks back home that if indeed 458 does become law, that there will be a covenant on the land and restricting it to agriculture?
The guarantee is this legislature being satisfied that they have the proper covenants on the legislation to preserve it in agricultural status.
Could there be anything within the bill itself that would say fee simple title with agricultural covenants?
As far as I'm concerned, it says that.
I don't have the expertise. I'm asking. It says that within the bill.
That's right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, sir.
Through the chair, Mr. Chairman, Representative Bettisworth, could you call my attention to the language in the bill that would provide that?
Are you referring to Section B?
Well, I'm seeing here maybe the language that you're thinking of is
the commissioner may require submission
of final
development.
Yeah, page 2, line 7, starting line 789.
Well, how about, if I may, Mr. Chairman, page 119, where it says the commissioner may require the submission of a development plan and covenants specified by the commissioner regarding agricultural uses of the land. And if that said chill instead of me, I think there would be a better guarantee. Mm-hmm.
That's
line 19. Could it,
Representative Gall.
And just to make it perfectly clear, would it be the same meaning in your view if it said something like the commissioner shall require a development plan with covenants specifying agricultural use of the land or requiring agricultural use of the land so there won't be any misunderstanding? Is that possible?
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
And does that go with your intent?
Under the current statutes under which the state disposes this land, there is in that statute a requirement for a development plan. So that's why this bill doesn't go into great detail on that, because that's already in statute. But they must do it. This bill says that on a satisfactory completion of your development plan, then I want you to be able to receive fee title of that land and maintain agricultural status.
My question was just one of language, because I understand that that's the intent, and I'm not questioning that at all. I'm just curious about how tight we could make the language. And I see what you're saying about the development plan, so maybe I would rephrase my question and say something like, before conveying, et cetera, shall require the submission of a development plan with covenants requiring agricultural use rather than specified by the commissioner regarding agricultural use.
When it comes to the wording to accomplish what we want to accomplish, I will not claim to be an expert on how best to do this.
You feel that wording would accomplish your intent and would not violate your intent?
As far as I can see, it would.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Cowder.
Yes, would this bill, to the sponsor, would this make private financing available for home loans?
That's the intent.
Yeah.
That's the desire.
Yeah. Would this then open up land developers or speculators rather than farmers? Would it be opening up some agricultural land for that?
We've been accused that it will, but that is not the intent.
Would this bill allow a farmer to develop a portion of his land so they could financially be able to farm the remainder?
Develop it how?
Develop it or subdivide or sell or for whatever that?
No.
Wouldn't have that effect?
No.
Would this have any effect on local governments as far as zoning or ordinances that you're affecting? No.
No.
Thank you.
Representative Larson.
Thank you. One of the problems that have been pointed out to me with the present conditions is, of course, really the regulations that exist under the Farm Development Plan and the Farm Conservation Plan, anywhere from how high the grass has to be at a certain time. And I guess my question is, would we be correcting that situation in this bill, or is that something else we have to direct our attention to?
Representative.
I'm sure what Representative Larson is referring to is a gentleman from the Point McKenzie area who testified at the hearing that the restrictions, that is in the development plan and does not flow through into the title that's being presented on completion of that plan currently by DNR. That should be corrected, but no, that is not corrected in this bill.
Thank you.
If I may, I just want to interject here something. There is another committee meeting scheduled here at 4:30. What I'd like to do, we have one other person left to testify. And I'd like to ask that person to come forth and testify. And if you could make it as brief as possible, I would appreciate it. I hate to cut you off, Al, but it's I was just notified of that just now.
Well, what is that? What's happening here at 4:30?
Loans Committee.
Oh.
That is
I had a speech, and I'm not good at speeches, so I guess I'll just try to describe what my problem is here.
I need your name and...
Oh, I'm sorry. Al Enright is my name, Mr. Chairman.
And you represent?
And I represent myself, my wife, and family.
You're from where?
I'm from Gustavus.
Okay. How many parcels are there in Gustavus?
Six or five in my original lottery, and I believe a couple of years afterwards, there was one other parcel. I could be corrected on that. I'll just pass these around. Some of you have seen them. The state did not, I don't know even know how to start now. I'm kind of confused.
Just take your time.
Take my time, huh? I went ahead last week.
We can run a few minutes late. Don't let it make you nervous.
Okay. Last week I called contractors in Juneau here and I got quotes from them. And Gastonal Contractors quoted, and originally it was $8,000, now it's $5,000because I had 40 acres. But I have 80 acres that I must clear of my 160, that's mandated by law. If it was $5,000, it would cost me $400,000 to have Gastonal come in, and you're welcome to have that when you look at it. If I were to have Channel Construction do the work for me, it was a move-out in figure of $7,000 and a $6,500 clearing cost. What I'm trying to represent here is that I came from Ketchikan, I paid $20,000 for a lot down there in 76, built my home there. I was hungry for land, you had the Byrne Initiative that I voted for. That home, it was a Homestead Act. Instead, we had policymakers that said that that wasn't feasible, we should make it more equitable or whatever, and we distribute the land quite differently. In 1979, my only alternative, if I chose to have 160 or whatever, was to go through a lottery, and I had to participate in the program that was acceptable at that time. Well, anyway, what happened then is I applied for all these parcels. I paid my $10 fee and so forth. I wasn't guaranteed of what parcel I would receive. It was just that by luck I ended up with this one, let's assume. It came about in January of 1980. I immediately flew to Gustavus. I did not have access to this property, so I hiked down a BLM. I found the markers and so forth. I hiked the property, and it was kind of a farce. I had to have a farm conservation plan in by the 22nd, and all that I have record of to prove that, and you're welcome to that information. I sent that farm conservation plan in to those individuals. They lost it. I have reference to that in my information here. And so I immediately called them on the 20th. I guess they requested that I send another copy of that. Anyway, what happened is they accepted my farm conservation plan. They sent me a contract. And the funny part of it, in a brochure here, this isn't the brochure that I have, but this is state land selections here that the state puts out. It says agricultural lands are those which meet U.S. Soil and Conservation Services standards for soil, climate, precipitation, drainage, accessibility, and other factors which may enhance agricultural development. They turn around after I receive this contract, after I've sent them the $800 deposit and so forth, I receive number 7 of my contract, and it says denial of warranty regarding conditions. The seller makes no warranty, express or implied, nor assumes any liability whatsoever regarding the social, economic, environmental aspects of that parcel, to include without limitation the soil conditions, water drainage, or natural or artificial hazards which may or may not exist, the appropriateness of the land classification, or the profitability or fitness of the parcel for any use. That's what the government sent to me in a contract. After I purchased agricultural land, this is what I received some point in time later. What I'm saying is